Roosevelt's children never suffered from a lack of opportunity to master their buck fever. On one occasion, their father found a big hollow tree that had a wide opening 20 feet up. Perfect, he thought, for dangling small children in. "With much labor, I got up the tree," Roosevelt proudly wrote to his sister Bammy, "and let each child in turn down the hollow by a rope." His method for teaching his children to swim was not much gentler. He took them to a dock and ordered them to leap into the deep water. His oldest child, Alice, was particularly frightened of diving, but her father was not about to let her off the hook. He would shout, "Dive, Alice! Now, dive!" until finally, trembling with fear, she would launch her tiny body into the cold, dark water. Kermit, although he was always a sober little boy and less demonstrative than his siblings, worked as hard as any of the children to please his father and prove himself. There was never any question that he had been paying attention during his childhood scrambles across Oyster Bay. The problem was that Roosevelt's lessons in manliness may have struck too deep a chord in his second son. Kermit had become almost too fearless, and certainly too reckless for even his father's comfort. Although Roosevelt was proud of his son's physical strength and courage, he worried that Kermit's thirst for adventure was ungoverned by the kind of wisdom that comes with age, and untempered by even a small measure of caution. Roosevelt's letters home from Africa had been filled with stories of Kermit's utter disregard for danger and his own incessant fretting. To his sister Corinne he had written, "Kermit is a great pleasure to me, and of course often a cause of much concern. Do you remember how timid he used to be? Well, my trouble with him now is that he is altogether too bold, pushing daring into recklessness." Kermit had faced down charging lions, elephants, and rhinoceroses in Africa. He had disappeared into the bush for 2 months with one of their guides and returned, Roosevelt wrote, "a better hunter than I am." But Roosevelt knew that all of his son's courage and skill could not save him if he continued to act carelessly. "Since I have been out here, 12 men have been killed or mauled by lions," he had written Corinne. "And naturally, when Kermit shows a reckless indifference to consequences when hunting them, I feel like beating him." Now, on the River of Doubt, Roosevelt's old fears for his son's safety had returned with a vengeance, and he winced every time Kermit climbed into his dugout to set off ahead of the rest of the expedition. Roosevelt wrote that Kermit was a great comfort and help to him on this expedition, but he admitted that he could never completely relax while his son pushed along on the unknown river so far ahead of him. "The fear of some fatal accident befalling him," he wrote, "was always a nightmare to me." Although Roosevelt had long lectured Kermit about his recklessness, his advice appeared to have had little effect on his son's actions. It certainly did not that afternoon on the River of Doubt, as he ordered his paddlers to carry him to the island that rested in the center of the rapids. Feeling that they had no choice but to obey Kermit's command, Juan and Simplicio braced their paddles against the bank and shoved off. The three men successfully rode the current downstream and halfway across the river to the island. As soon as they disembarked, however, they realized that Rondon was right. There was no safe channel on either side of the river. Now they were not only stranded on the island, they were farther down the river than they had been, and closer to the thundering waterfall. Kermit ordered the camaradas to board the dugout and cross back to the left bank. "Both Jean and Simplicio," Roosevelt wrote, "were exceptionally good men in every way." But they balked at this command. Kermit had to repeat his order before they reluctantly dug their paddles into the rushing river. The three men were on their journey back when their canoe was suddenly struck by one of the shifting whirlpools that they had seen the day before. The vortex spun them around, and as Kermit shouted to his steersman to turn the dugout so that it would take the inevitable blow head-on rather than broadside, forced them over the fall. Incredibly, when they reached the bottom, their small canoe, which Roosevelt complained was the least seaworthy of all, was still upright. However, it had taken in so much water, it could hardly float. Realizing that their only chance for survival was to make it to the shore, Juan and Simplicio paddled as fast and as hard as they could. They had just pulled themselves to within grasping distance of the bank when another whirlpool sucked them in and spat them back out into the middle of the river. Fighting to save not just his companions, but their crude canoe, Zhuang leapt into the water and desperately grabbed a hawser that had been tied to the bow. Straining against the rope, he tried to drag the dugout back to the bank as he slipped and stumbled over the riverbed. The current, however, was too strong for him. It quickly ripped the hawser out of his hands, flipped the canoe over, and hurled it downstream. The last thing that Zhuang saw as the dugout swirled out of sight was Simplicio and Kermit clinging to its splintered, capsized hull. From their canoe above the rapids, Roosevelt and Cherry had watched in horror as Kermit, Zhuang, and Simplicio struggled to maintain control of their dugout and then disappeared over the waterfall. Shouting to their paddlers to pull over, they had scrambled out of their canoe and raced along the uneven bank until they reached the bottom of a second waterfall. What they saw there would have stopped any father's heart. Kermit's dugout lay among the rocks, as Cherry would later write, crushed to splinters. Part 4. Iron Cruelty. Chapter 18. Attack. As his father strained desperately to catch a glimpse of him in the roiling river, Kermit fought for his life downstream. When his dugout was swept over the second waterfall, the impact had crushed the boat and hurled Kermit, Simplicio, and Kermit's dog into the water. Kermit was alive and conscious, but his battle with the river was only beginning. His favorite rifle, the .405 Winchester he had carried in Africa, was knocked from his hands, and the rushing water blinded, choked, and pummeled him. Like a relentless hammer, the torrent drove his broad, hard sun helmet over his face and forced his body down to the jagged riverbed. His waterlogged jacket became an anchor, dragging him to the bottom of the river. Somewhere in the middle of the raging rapids, Simplicio was also being propelled through layers of white foam and black water. The powerful rushing water and deadly whirlpools created by the rocky riverbed swept him violently downstream, threatening at any moment to pull him under long enough for his life, in Roosevelt's words, to be beaten out on the boulders beneath the racing torrent. While Kermit and Simplicio struggled in the river, Rondon was walking back along its left bank, unaware of their plight, having found the portage route that he was looking for. As he approached his canoe, preoccupied with his orders for the camaradas, he was suddenly startled by what he saw, or rather, did not see, in front of him. He had expected to find Kermit's dugout tied to a tree alongside his own. Turning to his pilot, a well-respected camarada named Antonio Correa, Rondon demanded to know what had happened after he left. He listened in astonishment as Antonio told him that Kermit had blatantly disobeyed his command. Furious, and worried that Kermit had put his boat and its precious provisions at risk, Rondon turned and hurried with Lira toward the falls. In the distance, the two men caught sight of Kermit's dog, Trigueiro, running toward them. The closer the dog approached, the greater Rondon's concern became and the faster he began to walk, until he and Lira were practically running along the river's edge. By the time they reached Trigueiro, it was obvious to both men that the dog had been thrown into the river. Trigueiro was soaking wet. More ominously, he was alone. Rushing past the dog, Rondon and Lira raced to the bottom of the first waterfall. As they approached the crest of a small hill, they saw a lone figure climbing toward them on the other side. It was Kermit, drenched, battered, and weak with exhaustion, but alive. Rondon's first reaction was overwhelming relief. His relief, however, quickly gave way to anger. Rondon was not accustomed to being disobeyed, even by the son of a former president of the United States. By refusing to listen to him, Kermit had endangered the entire expedition. When Kermit was finally standing before him, Rondon's rage boiled over into sarcasm. "Well," he said caustically, You have had a splendid bath, eh? Standing on the narrow, muddy trail, water running in rivulets down his pants and pooling at his feet, Kermit tried to explain what had happened to him and, he believed, Zhuang and Simplicio. After he was driven to the bottom of the river by the rapids, a back current had carried him to a stretch of swift but calm water. Almost drowned, his breath and strength almost spent, he had spotted an overhanging branch and recognized it as his best and probably last chance for survival. Grabbing the branch, he had hauled himself out of the river. Trigueiro, who had been by Kermit's side throughout the ordeal, scrambled up the bank next to his master as he collapsed on the shore. Zhuang and Simplicio, Kermit now told Rondon, must have swum to safety on the other side of the river. But he did not know what had happened to his canoe or its contents. Accepting Kermit's assumption that everyone was probably safe, Rondon and Lyra focused their attention on the problem of portaging around the second waterfall, which they had not even known existed until they heard Kermit's story, and searching for his canoe and any provisions that might have survived the rapids. As valuable as the canoe itself was the cargo that it had been carrying, essential boat-building tools as well as 10 days' worth of rations, the loss of which would be devastating. No sooner had Kermit walked away, however, than Zhuang appeared before Rondon and Lyra. As Kermit had guessed, Zhuang had emerged from the river on the other side and had somehow managed to make his way back across. But he had not seen Simplicio, since the camarada had disappeared over the second waterfall with Kermit. Rondon ordered an immediate manhunt. It was, he wrote, their one hope left. After a frantic search which extended about a mile downstream, however, the men were able to recover nothing more than a battered paddle and a single box of rations. It was clear to them all what had happened. Unfortunately, the moment arrived when it was impossible to deceive ourselves, Rondon wrote. Simplicio was drowned. That night, after the men, now numbering only 21, had finished their portage around the last waterfall, they retired to their tents and hammocks. Hunched over his small table, Roosevelt acknowledged in the article he was writing that his son had had a very narrow escape. Had they lost Kermit rather than Simplicio that day, he wrote, he did not think he could have borne the pain of bringing bad tidings to his betrothed and to his mother. Kermit's near drowning had been a result of the young man's own recklessness, but Roosevelt felt a heavy weight of responsibility for having chosen to descend this dangerous river and for having brought his son along with him. Although Kermit had joined the expedition in order to protect his father, Roosevelt's mission from this point onward would be to protect Kermit and to ensure that he made it out of the rainforest alive. Having faced his own mortality and having caused, albeit indirectly, another man's death, Kermit showed no signs of remorse or even any sense of responsibility when he scribbled a brief account of the day's events in his journal that night. He recorded the fact of Simplicio's death as tersely and unemotionally as he did his own near drowning. Simplicio was drowned, he wrote. If he felt sorrow for Simplicio's death, or regret for his own rash decision to cross to the other side of the river when Rondon had warned him not to, he did not admit it in his diary. Nor did he appear to have any desire to change his ways. If Roosevelt had hoped that this tragedy had driven some degree of fear or even caution into his son, he was to be disappointed. The man who seemed to be most shaken by what had happened that day was Cherry. Having spent half his life traveling through South American jungles, he understood the gravity of their situation better than did Kermit or Roosevelt, and he was more concerned about surviving the journey than was Rondon. Although he regretted Simplicio's death, he was much more disturbed that they had lost Kermit's dugout and most of its cargo. "The loss of a human life is always a tragedy," he wrote. "But the loss of the canoe and its contents was an even greater tragedy to the remaining members of our party." In his last letter home, which he had written the day before they launched their boats on the river. Cherry had told his wife, Stella, that he hoped to be back in Vermont in time to help sow the spring crops at Rocky Dell. "We may reach New York by the end of May," he had written. "I hope we shall, for I would like very much to be able to help get in the potatoes and other crops." He realized now, however, that if he was ever going to see his family or Rocky Dell again, the expedition could not afford any more losses like those they had suffered that day. Grandon, although angry that Kermit's disobedience had cost him the life of one of his men, was neither shocked by Simplicio's death nor deterred by it. "Certainly no one commences an enterprise of the kind in which we were engaged without having previously become acquainted with the idea of the danger which same may offer, and of the innumerable occasions in which one has to face death," he wrote. For Rondon, death was merely one of the many costs of achieving a much larger goal that had already cost the lives of countless of his men, opening the country's interior and integrating the Amazon's native peoples into Brazilian society. Few Brazilians, including many of Rondon's soldiers, shared his passion for contacting and befriending Indians, or even believed that such a thing was possible. Backed by a number of vocal civilians, his men resented the sacrifices that they were expected to make in the name of their commander's ideals. At one point, a group of rubber plantation owners wrote to the Brazilian newspaper A Cruz that Rondon lets his soldiers die of hunger while distributing food to the savages. In the most remote reaches of the Amazon, however, Rondon was unreachable and unstoppable. He had never allowed his men's suffering or even their deaths to affect his work in the wilderness, and he never would. "Death and dangers, in spite of how much suffering they bring," he wrote, "should not interfere with the expedition's mission." The next morning, March 16th, the men awoke ready to face the river once again. While the rain fell heavily in the still dark forest, they gathered around Rondon to listen to his orders of the day. As a representative of the Brazilian government, Rondon perpetuated the name of the unfortunate Simplicio by officially naming for him the waterfall that had ended his young life. Simplicio was unmarried, so Rondon and Roosevelt agreed that, if they survived this journey, they would send the money that he would have earned to his mother. Unable to do anything more for the young man who had lost his life for their ambition, they carved a short inscription on one side of their camp marker. "In these rapids died poor Simplicio," and solemnly walked away. There was no doubt in anyone's mind that they had another hard and dangerous day ahead of them. The day before, during their desperate search for Simplicio, they had found another series of rapids downstream, even worse than the one that had drowned the camarada. Further complicating the situation was the fact that they now had 21 men and only 5 canoes, and none of the trees near their camp were suitable material for dugouts. Some of the men would have to walk. At 7 a.m., in a blinding rain, Kermit climbed into the expedition's large new canoe and set off ahead of the rest of the boats, just as he had for the past 2.5 weeks. After only half an hour on the river, the men reached the rapids that they had known awaited them. As Kermit had already explored the left side of the river in his search for Simplicio, Rondon and Lyra paddled to the right side, where they found a channel that circumvented the worst part of the rapids. Luiz and Antonio Correa, the expedition's 2 best watermen, were then charged with the job of lowering the empty dugouts by ropes from the right bank. At the same time, the rest of the camaradas would begin cutting a half-mile-long portage road along the left bank for the baggage carry. Having satisfied himself that all of his men were suitably engaged in useful work, Rondon took his favorite dog, Lobo, and set off over a hill just behind their camp, in the hope of finding game or, failing that, Brazil nuts. Although the rest of the men rarely left camp alone, especially after they saw the abandoned Indian village and found the pattern, Rondon was most at ease when he was on his own. He was, and had always been, a loner. He had found his own way in the world, first as an orphan, and then as an outsider at the military academy in Rio de Janeiro. Even after he had married, he had been separated for long periods of time and by hundreds of miles from his wife and children. Francisca Rondon had suffered as much as any of her husband's soldiers over the past 22 years. She had been raised as a sheltered city girl in Rio de Janeiro, the daughter of one of Rondon's professors at the military school. But soon after she married, she had left that life behind, moving to remote Mato Grosso to be closer to Candido. Since then, she had given birth to 7 children, endured isolation and illness, including malaria and yaws, an infectious tropical disease that attacks the skin and bones, and been forced to carry on without her husband for months and even years at a time. She finally taught herself telegraphic code so that she could send brief messages to him while he was in the field. On their 9th wedding anniversary, in February 1901, Rondon had sent her a wistful telegram. "This day brings us sweet remembrances of the past. Let us accept our sad life. Miss you deeply. Embraces. Candido." In the field, surrounded by hundreds of men, Rondon had found his job as commander to be a lonely and friendless one. But for a handful of close confidants, such as Lira and Amilcar, Rondon's only companionship had come from his dogs. At times he had as many as 20 dogs in his camp, and he always had a favored pack of 3 or 4 that were constantly by his side. They did not complain or mutiny, and they were cheerful, trustworthy, and devoted to their master. There was no question that Rondon cared more for these dogs than he did for his own men, or that he worried about their safety and comfort. He showered them with affection, shared his food with them, and on one occasion even halted a march so that they could rest. On another march, he had carried one of his dogs in his arms so that he would not die of exhaustion. Although he rarely devoted more than a single sentence in his journal to the death of one of his men, Rondon penned heartfelt eulogies to his dogs. After his dog, Volcan, died, for instance, he wrote, "Travel companion who guarded my tent, poor companion, how I feel your death, you who served me so well, without my being able to pay you back for half of your dedication." Now, contentedly walking through the forest with faithful Lobu at his side, Rondon turned north after cresting the hill behind the expedition's camp and headed back in the direction of the River of Doubt. After following the river about a mile downstream, he came to a point at which a narrow canal split off from the main waterway. Making his way through the tangle of trees and vines along the canal, Rondon suddenly heard the unmistakable quavering whinny of the coatá, or spider monkey, the largest primate in the Amazon rainforest. Taking 1,000 precautions so that he would not frighten the monkey, Rondon crouched down in the thick vegetation and slowly made his way toward the sound. As he scanned the trees' highest branches, where he knew the coatá lived, he could imagine his men's delight when he walked into camp holding a 20-pound spider monkey by its long, dark tail. The forest was typically quiet, and Rondon did his best not to snap branches or rustle leaves as he crept through the underbrush. Excited by the hunt, Lobo sprinted ahead of his master and quickly disappeared from view. Moments later, the silence was rent by a high-pitched yelp. Certain that Lobu had been attacked by an animal, a jaguar or perhaps a peccary, Rondon braced himself for the worst. Then he heard something even more bone-chilling, the sound of human voices. "These were well known to me," he would later recall. "They were short exclamations, energetic, and repeated in a kind of chorus with a certain cadence peculiar to Indians who, when they are ready for the fight, commence the attack on the enemy." At that moment, Rondon was the enemy, and he had no protection beyond his rifle and the cover of the rainforest. His only hope was to remain as invisible to the Indians as they were to him. Suddenly, Lobu reappeared, staggering toward his master and giving away Rondon's hiding place. As the dog drew near, Rondon could see two long arrows protruding from his side. In desperation, with the Indian's war cries ringing in his ears, Rondon raised his rifle and fired into the air. The blast shook the leaves around him and put startled animals to flight. But the Indians kept coming. Although Rondon still could not see Lobu's attackers, he could hear them clearly, chattering excitedly to one another from the dense cover of the rainforest. He fired his other barrel, but the war whoops continued. Finally, realizing that he could not defend himself against certain attack, Colonel Rondon turned and fled. He found the rest of the men at the foot of the rapids, where he had established the expedition's next camp earlier that morning. Gathering his officers together, he told them what had happened. Their worst fear had been realized. The Indians that lived on the River of Doubt were no longer ghosts. They were real, and they were prepared to attack. The others had alarming news of their own. While Rondon was gone, they had lost another canoe. Luis and Antonio Correa had successfully brought one of the dugouts down the channel. But as they were lowering the large canoe that they had built themselves just a few days earlier, the rope had broken and the canoe had been swept into a colony of boulders. Luis had almost been swept away with it. The other camaradas had managed to save him, but they had not been able to save the canoe, or the ropes and pulleys that it had carried. Rondon was deeply concerned about the loss of the new dugout, but the Indians worried him more. Turning to Lira and Kermit, he asked them to return with him to the scene of the attack. They agreed, and, taking Dr. Cajazeira and Antonio Paresi with them, immediately set out to retrace Rondon's steps. By the time the five men reached the canal, the Indians had vanished. The men discovered a few items that they had left behind, however, including a small basket filled with animal entrails and tied to a long rod. Rondon guessed that the basket had been used for fishing. The Indians, he thought, must have lowered it into the river, waited for fish to swim over to the bait, and then speared them with their arrows. Kneeling down, he placed some gifts, a couple of axes and a few beads, next to the basket, a gesture he hoped would send the message that not only did he and his men not want to be the Indians' enemies, but they hoped to be their friends. Scanning the forest, the men found a rough trail that led across the canal and had clearly been the Indians' path of retreat. Then, Rondon found another, more grisly trail. Drops of blood smeared on leaves and dripped on branches. He followed the bloody trail for about 300 yards until, at its end, he found Lobu. The dog had tried to make his way back to camp, but had finally collapsed. The arrows that had killed him still protruded from his small body. One had struck his left leg and torn away the muscle. The other had entered his stomach just below his heart. That arrow had been launched with such force that it had been driven completely through his body, and its blood-stained tip emerged from the other side. Looking down at Lobu, no one could have any doubt that the Indian's intent had been to kill, and that, had Rondon walked into the ambush first, it would have been his body, rather than Lobu's, that lay in a pool of blood on the forest floor. Despite his sorrow and fear, Rondon refused to abandon his principles. "These melancholic reflections," he wrote, "did not divert me away from my habitual norm of conduct regarding the Indians." He had faced hostile Indians before and would likely do so again, and he was more worried about alienating them than dying at their hands. Rondon had long argued that Indians attacked only when forced to do so. In fact, he claimed that 90% of the Indian attacks that took place in Brazil were nothing more than acts of self-defense and retaliation. The idea that Indians might attack the expedition for reasons of fear or self-defense offered little comfort to Roosevelt, who noted wryly, "If you are shot by a man because he is afraid of you, it is almost as unpleasant as if he shot you because he disliked you." Even Rondon was shaken by what he found when he knelt down to get a closer look at the arrows that had impaled Lobu. Since the expedition had passed the abandoned village more than 2 weeks earlier, Rondon had assumed that the Indians that surrounded them in the rainforest were Nambikara, members of the tribe with whom he had made first contact 7 years earlier. But as he examined these arrows, he realized that he was wrong. The arrow that had impaled Lobu had a point that was shaped like a barbed lance and was made from bamboo. This, Rondon knew, was not the work of the Nambikara. The River Duvida, he concluded, was inhabited by a new tribe of Indians, with regard to which we possessed no information. Rondon did not know these Indians, and they did not know him. There was not even the pretense of peace between them and the outside world. Rondon, moreover, could only assume that, whoever these Indians were, they would defend their land as fiercely as the Nambikara had defended theirs. The critical difference was that he had been able to retreat after being attacked by the Nambikara. Now, retreat was impossible. In fact, in order to survive, they would have to go deeper into the territory of this unknown tribe. A land where, they now knew with certainty, they were not welcome. Chapter 19. The Wide Belts. By roughly 2 million years ago, humans had spread out of Africa and into Europe and Asia. Hundreds of thousands of years later, they migrated to Australia and New Guinea, which were then connected as a single continent. Because they did not yet have boats and could not endure the cruel cold of Siberia, tens of thousands of years more passed before they crossed the Bering Land Bridge and made their way into the Americas. When they finally began to populate North America, however, human beings quickly dispersed throughout the continent and, by crossing the Panamanian land bridge, soon reached South America. Some 12,000 years ago, they entered the Amazon. In the eyes of the rest of the world, the humans who reached the Amazon basin virtually disappeared. For thousands of years, there was no further contact with the Amazonians. Whereas most regions of the world continued to change and interact, to form new peoples and nations by fusing races and cultures, the inhabitants of the Amazon remained insular and isolated. Even in 1500, when European explorers began to land on the shores of South America, claiming the land for themselves and their kings and enslaving its aboriginal inhabitants, the continent's vast interior remained untouched, and its people unknown and unreachable. After the Spanish explorer Orellana finally penetrated the Amazon basin in 1542, he returned with startling tales of dense jungles, deadly poisons, and, most astonishing of all, a tribe of vicious women warriors. The expedition's chronicler, the Dominican friar Gaspar de Carvajal, described the women as going about naked, but with their privy parts covered, with their bows and arrows in their hands, doing as much fighting as 10 Indian men. Orellana named these women the Amazons, after the famed women warriors of Greek mythology, who were said to have removed their right breast so that they could more effectively shoot a bow and arrow. It is from the Greek word amazos, or no breast, that the word Amazon is derived. After Orellana, few outsiders disturbed the Amazon's native peoples for the next 200 years. In the mid-18th century, however, things changed dramatically and, for the Amazon's human inhabitants, disastrously. While traveling down the Amazon River from Ecuador, the French naturalist and mathematician Charles-Marie de la Condamine saw natives extracting a milky substance from a tall tree. After the strange liquid, which the Indians called caoutchouc, had coagulated, it was used to make everything from boots to bottles. La Condamine saw potential in caoutchouc and brought a sample with him back to France. When the strange pliable substance made its way across the channel, the British soon discovered that it worked extremely well as an eraser, and so began referring to it as rubber. By the end of the 18th century, rubber was well known and widely used throughout Europe and the New World. By the middle of the 19th century, the Amazon was exporting more than 150 metric tons of it each year. La Condamine's discovery meant great wealth for a few South Americans and Europeans, but nothing but sorrow and terror for Amazonian Indians. Settlers who had made their way to the Amazon in the hope of making their fortunes in rubber quickly became frustrated by the dearth of willing cheap labor and began to organize slaving expeditions. Already laid low by European diseases, many Indian tribes were nearly decimated by these expeditions. Those Indians who survived were perhaps even less fortunate than those who lost their lives. Rubber barons were notorious for treating their slave laborers with exceptional cruelty. Julio César Arana, the son of a Peruvian hat maker who made millions of dollars harvesting and selling Amazonian rubber in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, ordered his men to go into the rainforest with rifles to recruit Indians. The tens of thousands of men, women, and children whom they rounded up were shackled into chain gangs. If they did not make their quotas, Arana's men would burn them alive, hang and quarter them, or shoot off their genitals. During the 12 years that Arana held his reign of terror along the banks of the Rio Putumayo, the native population plummeted from more than 50,000 to less than 8,000. Those who survived did so with horribly disabling and disfiguring wounds that became known as La Marca Arana, the Mark of Arana. The Indians' only advocates were the missionaries who had already established themselves in the Amazon by the early 17th century, searching for souls to save. They made an effort to protect their charges, but they were powerless against wealthy and merciless settlers such as Arana. Their best hope came in offering the Indians as wage laborers instead of slaves. The settlers, however, reverted back to slavery when they found that they could not get as many laborers as they needed and did not have as much control over them as they had had over their slaves. Even the missionaries themselves wanted to force the Indians into reductions or missions in which they were made to wear clothing and worship the Christian God. Before Rondon's Indian Protection Service was established in 1910 and even after, the Indians' best protector was the Amazon itself. So dense and dangerous was the rainforest that few white men were able to venture very far into it, even for the promise of rubber. Despite the intense search for Indians by the men who wanted their labor or their souls, several tribes had not yet had any contact with the outside world by the time Roosevelt reached South America in 1913. Even those who had had some limited contact with outsiders were so isolated by the jungle in which they lived that they did not have even the vaguest understanding of what the rest of the world looked like. Such isolation makes it well nigh impossible for them to grasp the significance of large communities, George Cherry observed. The distant villager is incapable of picturing a much larger group of human beings living together than that in his own tiny settlement. They picture the rest of the world as one of jungles, great rivers, and vast seas, with here and there tiny pools of humanity no larger than their own. Thus it is that they look upon the stranger from afar as a traveler between villages. The mysterious Indians who surrounded Roosevelt and his men on the banks of the River of Doubt were so isolated that they had never seen a white man. The intersection of their world and that of Roosevelt and Rondon was not simply a clash of different cultures. It was a collision of the Industrial Age and the Stone Age, the modern world and the ancient. Known by modern anthropologists as the Cinta Larga, which is Portuguese for wide belt, a reference to the strips of bark that they strap around their waists. This tribe had remained shrouded from the rest of the world not just by the impenetrable rainforest, but by the very thing that had exposed most Amazonian Indians to settlers and missionaries. A river. For European explorers, South America's rivers had long been the only highways into the interior. It had been along the Amazon River and some of its thousands of tributaries that they had discovered the rainforest and its occupants, and the Indians had discovered another world beyond their own. Some Amazonian tributaries, however, were so rapids-choked that they were impossible to ascend and too dangerous to descend. The River of Doubt's fierce rapids had dissuaded even the most determined settlers from exploring its course. The same rapids that had already cost the expedition the life of one man and had nearly robbed Roosevelt of his son had kept the Cinta Larga in a time capsule, which had been sealed for millennia. While the world in which Roosevelt lived had undergone dramatic recent changes, including skyscrapers, automobiles, and even airplanes, Orville and Wilbur Wright had made their first successful flight over Kill Devil Hill 11 years earlier, the Indians in this region were still using the simplest of tools. Their axes were ground and polished stone, and their cutting tools sharp slivers of bamboo. They made their fires by drilling a hard stick of wood into a softer one. The men all carried their hard drills with them while they were out hunting so that they could start a fire. So cut off from the outside world were the Cinta Larga that when they first saw the expedition, they were not even certain that Roosevelt, Rondon, and their men were human. By this point in their journey, most of the men in the expedition had grown rough beards, which looked strange and animalistic to the Cinta Larga, who, like all native Amazonians, had little facial or body hair. After watching the men from the shadows of the forest, the Cinta Larga mothers warned their children to sleep close to the fire at night so that there would not grow a patchy layer of fur like these strange creatures. The Cinta Larga must also have been curious about the expedition's canoes. As simple and crudely made as they were, the dugouts represented a level of technological sophistication that was unknown to the Cinta Larga. Although they lived on both sides of the River of Doubt, fishing from it, drinking from it, bathing in it, and traveling long distances along its banks, the Cinta Larga had not yet conceived of boats, even those as simple as the expedition's dugout canoes. The only means they had developed for crossing the river were simple rope and plank bridges. Nor, despite their dependence on the river, had they yet developed the means of fishing with a hook and line, relying instead on spears or arrows to kill the fish that were so central to their diet. Despite these limitations, and in part because of their isolation, the Cinta Larga were masters at surviving in the jungle. During their portages, the men of the expedition crashed through the underbrush, scaring off game and announcing their presence to the Indians. Even when they did not have to wrestle with their dugouts, the men found it nearly impossible to fight their way through the jungle. Long vines crisscrossed the forest. Sharp branches caught their loose clothing, snagging and ripping it, and holding them hostage while they struggled to set themselves free. In contrast to Roosevelt and his men, the Cinta Larga moved through the rainforest quickly and silently. They wore no clothing and so were able to slip through the tangle of vegetation unrestrained. The women, who wore their hair long and parted down the middle, had nothing on their bodies but necklaces of black vegetable beads, which they strung around their necks, wrists, waists, and ankles. But for a simple liana covering to protect their penises, the men were similarly naked. The Cinta Larga were also fast and invisible in the jungle because they had blazed trails that an outsider could not possibly discern or follow. Even if Rondon, in his ardor to make contact with this unknown tribe, had started down the Cinta Larga trail that he had found near Lobo's body, it would have been useless to him. The Cinta Larga's trails zigzagged through the forest, cutting in and out of thickets, crisscrossing the river, and going over rather than around any obstacle they encountered. The tribe's trails were marked, but ingeniously so. Markers appeared only once every 12 or 18 feet, and were simply small branches that the blazer had half broken and then bent backward. To anyone but a Cinta Larga, these markers were indistinguishable from any of a million other broken and bent branches in the rainforest. A change of direction was indicated by nothing more than a slightly larger broken branch, whose bent end vaguely pointed the way. Only the Cinta Larga knew, moreover, that the markers also showed the direction to and from their camp. In a system like that used in modern maritime navigation, markers were placed so that when approaching the tribe's camp, they appeared on the left side of the trail, and leading away from the camp, they appeared on the right. The Cinta Larga were as skilled at hunting as they were at trailblazing. While the men of the expedition slowly starved, wandering through what seemed to them to be a lush but empty rainforest, the Indians saw, heard, and smelled game everywhere they turned. Their ability to move soundlessly through the forest also helped them to sneak up on their prey, as the members of the expedition never could, and their skill with a bow and arrow was uncanny. These Indians were such expert hunters that they were even able to trick their game into coming to them. As Rondon had learned when they lured him with the whinny of the spider monkey, the Cinta Larga were talented mimics and could recreate nearly any animal call. In fact, so familiar were they with these calls that they used them not only to draw game within striking distance, but even to express time. When referring to a time before sunrise, for example, they used the cry of the howler monkey. One of the greatest frustrations that the men of the expedition faced on the River of Doubt was that they were descending a river crowded with fish that they could not catch. Those same fish, however, were easy prey for the Cinta Larga. The Indians made up for their lack of poles, lines, or hooks with the type of fishing basket that Rondon had found. More important, they had timbo, this milky liquid which the Cinta Larga extracted from a vine by pounding it with a rock, stuns, or, depending on the quantity, kills fish by paralyzing their gills. Used in slow-moving inlets and pools, timbo allowed the Indians to spear or scoop up the fish as they floated to the river's surface. As well as being expert hunters and fishermen, the Cinta Larga had access to crops that Roosevelt and his men did not, and they were willing to consume a larger variety of protein sources. The Indians grew vegetables such as manioc, yams, and sweet potatoes, but even they struggled to do so. Clearing the land in the jungle was grueling work. It often took a man with a stone axe an entire day just to fell a single large tree. Then, while sowing his crops, he had to contend with the long tree roots that lay frustratingly near the surface of the soil. After only 3 or 4 years had passed, the cleared land, scorched by the sun, robbed of its nutrients by the growing crops, and deprived of the cyclical nutrient exchange that had sustained it when it supported a forest, would become depleted, and the Indians would be forced to find another patch of land to till. Each Cinta Larga village, which had 1 or 2 large houses that each held 3 to 5 families, was almost completely autonomous from the larger tribe, and every one had its own chief. The chief had to exhibit strong leadership qualities, such as taking the initiative in building a house or clearing a garden, but he was not their commander in the traditional sense. The Cinta Larga would not allow their village chief to tell them how to live their lives. Instead, the chief's job was to oversee the tribal ceremonies, an important role because the Cinta Larga did not have a written language. Their only ceremonial guides were their own memories and the stories that they had heard their parents and grandparents tell. Not only did the chief not command the village as a whole, he did not have power over any family within it but his own. Each man was the chief of his own family, which consisted of as many wives as he could convince to marry him, and as many children as his wives could bear. A Cinta Larga man usually chose a new wife as soon as his first wife began to age. Girls were considered to be ready for marriage when they were between 8 and 10 years old, and they often married their mother's brother. In such small communities, a young man ready to take his first wife often found that there were no eligible girls left in his village. He was then allowed to take a wife from a man who had 3 or more, or, failing that, he had to look for a wife in a neighboring village. It was not unusual for villages to trade women. The women, however, usually consented to the switch. Like women in most early cultures, the Cinta Larga women did not have a voice in tribal or even family decisions. However, the Indian women did have a surprising amount of control over their own lives. For instance, if a Cinta Larga woman was unsatisfied in her marriage, she was free to do something about it. She could dissolve the marriage, she could marry another man, or she could even stay with her husband and take a lover. In such circumstances, a husband would usually look the other way, unless he became the object of derision within his village. As important as children were to the future of a village, they were far from coddled, and they were expected to take on the role of an adult by the time they turned 12 years old. Also, although the Indians lived together in one or two large huts, they did not appear to feel any particular responsibility for anyone outside their own immediate family. Each family had its own corner of the hut and its own fire, and when a man had been out hunting and returned with game, his neighbors rarely benefited from his good fortune. The hunter ate first, then his wives, children, and other relatives, in that order. Although Roosevelt and Rondon did not realize it, the Cintalarga's strong independence was probably keeping the men of the expedition alive. Because the Indians did not have a traditional chief, they were forced to make all of their decisions by consensus. If it was time to move the village, for instance, they had to agree on the time and location of the move. When it came to dealing with the expedition, the Cintalarga were divided. Some of them believed that they should remain invisible to the outsider. Others, however, argued that they should attack. These men had invaded their territory, and there was no reason to believe they did not mean the Indians harm. By attacking first, the Cintalarga would have the upper hand. They would also be able to loot the expedition, which was carrying valuable provisions and tools, especially those made of metal. War was not a rare event for the Cintalarga. The most common cause was the death of one of their own, from an earlier attack or even from natural causes. The Cintalarga believed that death was brought about by witchcraft. If a man became ill and died, the others in his village never blamed their healer, a man who used plants and religion to cure the sick. Instead, they looked around their own village, and if they did not find anyone suspicious, they assumed that someone from another village must have performed the dark magic. The only response was to avenge the death by attacking the offending village. The Cintalarga also occasionally went to war if the population of their own village had become so depleted by disease, murder, or both, that they needed to steal women and children. Such attacks took place at night. The men would camp near their victim's village, and then, after the sun had set, they would slip inside their communal hut. As the male members of the other village slept in their hammocks, the warriors would club them to death before rounding up as many women and children as they could find. Although the Cintalarga rarely wore much adornment, when they went to war, they dressed for the part. They would cut their hair very short, place hawk feather headdresses over their shorn heads, paint their bodies with animal and plant extracts, and hang bead necklaces from their necks. The most important item in the Cintalarga's war dress, however, was the wide belt for which the Portuguese would later name them. These belts were made from the curatari tree, which was difficult to find. The men were sometimes forced to walk for several days in order to harvest the smooth, mahogany-colored bark of this tree. They wrapped an 8-inch-wide strip around their waists 1.5 times and then tied it tightly with a fine liana. The stiff bark, which was 1/10 of an inch thick, was uncomfortable and often cut their stomachs and backs, thus exposing them to infection. But the belt was ubiquitous among the warlike Cintalarga because it covered the abdomen and so was useful as body armor. Although skilled with both clubs and poison, the Cintalarga's most lethal weapons were bows and arrows. As Rondon learned when he examined the arrows that had killed Lobu, the Cintalarga's arrows were exquisitely made and deadly accurate. Made from bamboo, the shaft was adorned with braids of peccary hair and topped with a knife-shaped bamboo tip. The arrows were on average 5 feet long, nearly as tall as the Cintalarga men and taller than many of the women, and were adorned with hawk wings or curaso feathers, which stabilized them in flight. The tribesmen made several different types of arrows for shooting fish, birds, monkeys, large animals, and men. But they used only one type of bow. About 6 feet long, the bows were made from the trunk of the peach palm tree and were so stiff and difficult to pull that it is doubtful that any of the men in the expedition could have used a Cintalarga bow had they found one. The most striking fact about the Cintalarga, and one that would have alarmed the men of the expedition had they known it, was that these Indians were cannibals. Unlike the type of cannibalism much of the world had come to know, among desperate explorers, marooned sailors, and victims of famine, the Cinta Larga's consumption of human flesh was born not out of necessity, but out of vengeance and an adherence to tribal traditions and ceremony. The tribe had very strict rules for cannibalism. They could eat another man only in celebration of a war victory, and that celebration had to take place in the early evening. The man who had done the killing could not grill the meat or distribute it, and children and adults with small children would not eat it. If they did, the Cinta Larga believed, they would go mad. The most important rule of cannibalism within the tribe was that one Cinta Larga could not eat another. The tribe drew a clear distinction between its own members and the rest of mankind, which they considered to be other, and thus edible. An enemy killed during war, therefore, was ritually dismembered and eaten. While still on the battlefield, either in the enemy's village or in the forest, the Cinta Larga would carve up the body just as they would a monkey that they had shot down from the canopy. First, they would cut off and discard the man's head and heart. Then they would section off the edible portions, the arms, legs, and a round of flesh over the stomach. They grilled this meat over an open fire and brought it home to their village for their wives to slice and cook with water in a ceramic pan. If Indians from other tribes were considered other, then the men of the expedition, who did not even look human to the Cinta Larga, certainly fell into that category. Moreover, should the Indians attack the expedition, Roosevelt would likely be one of their first targets. After watching the expedition for several weeks, the Cinta Larga had surely figured out by now that Roosevelt and Rondon were its commanders. Not only did they give orders and do less physical work than the other men, but the camaradas and even the other officers clearly treated them with deference. Even if the Indians had only recently stumbled upon the expedition, they probably would have aimed for Roosevelt first, simply because of his substantial girth. The Cinta Larga often tossed pieces of a slain enemy into the jungle if they thought that he was too lean. Although Roosevelt had already begun to lose much of his 220 pounds to illness and the intense physical work and meager diet of the past few months, he was still by far the heaviest man in the expedition. If the men were massacred, the former president would make the best ceremonial meal. Chapter 20. Hunger. After a miserable night of worry and fear, the men of the Roosevelt-Rondon scientific expedition awoke on the morning of March 17th to the dire reality of their situation. They could not get back on the river, but neither could they stay where they were. The loss of the new dugout the day before had left them with only four canoes, three fewer than they had started out with, and far too few to carry 21 men and all of their food and equipment. There were no trees suitable for boat building anywhere near their camp. They were quickly running out of rations, and they were surrounded by hostile Indians. Whatever the cost, they had to keep moving, and most of the men would have to walk. By this point in the expedition, none of them had any illusions about what it meant to walk along the banks of the River of Doubt. So dense was the vegetation along the river's sun-washed shoreline that they would have to laboriously carve a path for each step with a machete. Although the dark interior of the rainforest offered a potentially easier route than the overgrown riverbank, that advantage was outweighed by the risks of dividing the expedition, and would have exposed those on foot to even greater risk of attack. Moving forward with only four canoes also meant that the men would have to leave behind almost anything that was not essential to their survival. "We left all the baggage we could," Roosevelt wrote. "We were already down as far as comfort would permit, but we now struck off much of the comfort." However, after months of similar cutbacks and the loss of much of their clothing to oxen, ants, and termites, they had so few personal items left that, as Roosevelt put it, "the only way to make a serious diminution was to restrict ourselves to the clothes on our backs." Early that morning, the expedition set off down the river once again. 8 men riding in the canoes, and 13 men walking. For better stability, the 4 dugouts had been tied together to form